For the last 10 years of his life, the astronomer and physicist Galileo was under house arrest. In the words of the Inquisition, he had been suspected of a grave heresy, that of believing and writing and teaching that the sun was the center of the universe. The year was 1633. Galileo's beliefs, his writings, and his thinking, as well as his teaching, were banned from that time on. I'm Susan McInnes. This is Conversations. And on this edition of Conversations, we go back to the life and times of Galileo to see what that life was like. Joining me is the eminent physicist, Dr. Keith Runcorn. Dr. Runcorn, thanks for joining us today. Can we begin with a context for Galileo's time? We live in a time when science and religion have quite separate lives, but this was not true in the time of Galileo.
No, culture at that time was integrated, and the commonly held view, of course, was that the Earth was at the center of the universe, and as appeared obvious to the ordinary person, the sun and the moon and the stars rotated, rising in the east, setting in the west, and this was part of a cosmology, as we would call it now, which was accepted and which, of course, seemed to fit the statements in the Bible that indicated that the Earth was solid and fixed.
Does this thinking come from Aristotle's thinking?
Yes. The Greeks, of course, made very great advances in science, and they set up what we would now call a model of the universe in which the sun and the moon and the stars rotated once a day in the firmament. They elaborated this because they knew that the sun and the moon and the stars rotate at slightly different apparent speeds. There's, of course, a solar day and a lunar day and a sidereal day. And they had a model in which the Earth was surrounded by three globes, crystal spheres, as they call them, in which the sun was embedded, another the moon, and a third all the stars except the planets. The motion of the planets was more complex, as the word for planet indicates. It's a Greek word for wanderer.
Was it that these thoughts and the biblical thoughts came together that allowed this thinking to exist for so many years, almost 2,000 years?
Well, religions tend to adopt the cosmology of the time, and the Greek cosmology, which was elaborated by the Alexandrian astronomer Ptolemy in the 2nd or 3rd century AD, that was accepted as a general cosmological background for theology.
Ptolemy also said that things on the earth might change. Green leaves turn brown, wood might burn, people might die. But beyond the earth, everything was perfect. Is that because that was God's realm as well?
Yes, this, of course, was a fundamental concept in theology, that the earth was in a fallen state, but the heavens were perfect because they were God's abode. And that fitted the or that was fitted in to the cosmology, and it was imagined that the sun and the moon were perfect spheres. See, perfection for the mathematician is a simple solid like a sphere. And so the whole of this scheme was, it fitted together very well. And so when, of course, the early scientists began to challenge parts of it and try and interpret observations in a new way, this was, of course, for the religious person, a threat.
Mm-hmm. And did it threaten the church as well as the church's way of thinking? Can those two be divided?
The because, of course, this cosmology was seemed to be in harmony with statements in the Bible. The most famous one is Joshua commanding the sun to stand still. Obviously, if it was fixed, it would be stupid for Joshua to say, stand still. And so that was a somewhat subtle text, which was regarded as implying that the earth was fixed. But there are many verses in the Psalms which talk about the earth as a fundamental basis which can't move. And the danger that the religious establishment saw was that if certain verses in the Bible were proved to be wrong, how would they defend very much more important statements?
This is Dr. Keith Runcorn, our guest today on Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, and today we're talking about Galileo. We need to get there first. Into this atmosphere came Copernicus, who began to think differently. Copernicus lived in the end of the 14th century, early 15th century, yes? No, backwards,
yes.
End of the 1400s, right. What did he see that made him think that, well, the sun was the center of the universe?
Well, Copernicus was born in Turin in Poland in 1473. It's rather interesting that that date is exactly halfway between the Turks' capture of Constantinople, which in many people's, many historians' views, was an important factor in starting the Renaissance. And the other date, 20 years later, very famous, was Columbus' discovery of America. So that gives one an idea of when Copernicus lived. He went to study in Italy, in the University of Bologna. The Renaissance was beginning, and it's probable that he read about early Greek speculations that the sun was at the center of the universe, and this began to interest him, and he went back to Poland and served the church there as a canon of the Cathedral of Frauenberg in the Baltic, and stayed there until he died in 1543. And gradually he collected together the ancient Greek observations of planetary motion, and saw that the observations on the planets, which had always given difficulty for the early cosmologies, could be understood rather more simply if the Sun was placed at the center of the solar system. And finally, spurred on by one of his colleagues in the church in Frauenberg, and partly by a young professor from Wittenberg in Germany who'd heard about his theory and went to learn about it, Copernicus agreed to publish his great work, De Revolutionibus Orbium Celestium, on the rotation of the heavenly spheres. And the book, printed in Germany, was brought to him on his deathbed in 1543. The book didn't create an immediate sensation, but knowledge of the Copernican ideas spread, and in 1616 it was placed on the index of forbidden books by the Roman Catholic Church. But it was also ridiculed by Martin Luther too, who said on one occasion, "This fool Copernicus is turning the whole art of astronomy upside down." Always in human affairs and in science particularly, new ideas are often met with ridicule.
I may have this right or I may have it wrong, but I've read that Copernicus said about the publishing of his book that Horace had advised you wait at least 9 years before setting a good thought down, and he waited 9 times 4 to set his down because he didn't believe the climate would accept his thinking. Do you think he worried, fretted for most of his academic life that his thoughts were out of step with the church, the country?
No. In fact, he got encouragement from the Pope and from one of the leading cardinals. The view that was quite common was that such studies of astronomy should be encouraged. And there's no doubt that Copernicus was more worried by the possibility of ridicule by ordinary people. You see, one of the clear objections to the idea that the Earth was moving was, why does the atmosphere move with the Earth? Why shouldn't it simply lag behind? And of course, the answer we now know is gravitation. But gravitation had not been discovered when Copernicus wrote. So there were many difficulties that people had in understanding how the Earth could orbit around the Sun and revolve around its axis without dire things happening to the Earth.
Mm-hmm. Into this time, into this thinking, came Galileo. First, tell us what you know about him as an intellect and a personality. He seemed very bright, but also quite arrogant, or maybe just didn't suffer fools.
Well, all the individuals, of course, involved in this scientific revolution of the 17th century were very different. Copernicus was a churchman, he was active in many ways in helping his uncle, who was a bishop, to administer this diocese in northern Poland. But he was a scholar who lived for the last 25 years of his life in the cathedral at Frauenberg. He corresponded, of course, with other scholars. But after him came Tycho Brahe, who was a Danish nobleman, who made a great contribution to astronomy by greatly improving the accuracy of the observations. Copernicus had to rely on a few of his own, made without the telescope, of course, and observations made 1,000 years before by the Greeks. No improvement had been made over that time. Tycho Brahe, even though he hadn't a telescope, had very accurate sighting devices, and on his island between Sweden and Denmark, he made great improvements in the knowledge of the motion of the planets. And he was, of course, very anxious to test the Copernican theory. He had a theory himself, which was a halfway house between the geocentric and the heliocentric systems. And then, of course, more or less contemporaneous with Galileo, there was Kepler, who also strongly believed in the Copernican system, in fact published books in favor of it before Galileo. But Galileo, learning about the invention of the telescope in Holland in 1610, made one himself and, of course, observed sunspots for the first time, showed the surface of the moon was irregular, it had topography like the Earth, and of course those two observations alarmed the theologians and the scholastic philosophers, because as I said earlier, they had assumed the heavens were perfect, and Galileo showed that the moon and the sun were not perfect spheres. Tycho Brahe, somewhat earlier, had observed what we call a supernova, and showed that it was a star which flared up and remained dazzlingly bright, visible in daylight for several months. And this again was a demonstration that the heavens were not permanent. And both he and Kepler observed comets and showed that the comets were in the heavens and were not in the atmosphere, as had previously been shown. So these observations were very important. And then most important of all was Galileo's discovery that Jupiter had a moon system, four moons. And, of course, even on the geocentric system, Jupiter moves so that the Jupiter moons moved with it. And so one of the basic objections against the Earth moving in orbit, that it would leave appendages behind, and the moon was such, that was shown to be untrue.
One of the ways that Galileo showed this to be untrue was to stand up on the masthead of a ship and drop a stone, which landed on the ship and not in the water behind the ship. And he said, if it was as you believe it, the stone would land in the water, because it is that the stone travels with the Earth, it doesn't fall behind. this was an entirely new way of looking not just at whether the Earth goes around the sun, but at how objects move. Is that not true?
Well, Galileo, of course, began to develop what we now know as the science of mechanics. And the great issue, of course, had always been what moves the planets. And even Kepler in his early days talked about the planets being moved around the Earth by souls, by
spirits.
He did. And, of course, in Greek times, the sun, moon, and stars rotating around the Earth rotated because of their assumed inherent properties. Circular motion, and don't forget, of course, early peoples had discovered the wheel. Circular motion seemed an entirely natural motion. And for Aristotle, there was no particular problem in explaining why the spheres holding the sun, the moon, and the stars rotated around the Earth once a day. And Copernicus adopted more or less the same hypothesis, that the planets now were rotating around the sun in more or less circular motion. But Kepler began to ask the question, what forces are needed to keep the planets moving in their orbits? And this, of course, was not answered until Newton's theory of gravitation. But the experiment that you refer to was probably never done by Galileo. It is what the Germans call a thought experiment. That is, an experiment that you think up and analyze and convince yourself what is the right answer. And it was concerned, of course, with whether a force was needed to keep a body moving in a straight line with constant speed when we're pushing something on the surface of the Earth. We need to apply a force to keep it moving. But, of course, at that time, they were familiar with trajectories of cannonballs. And the cannonball, of course, went up and fell, but it also went forward. And once it had left the barrel of the gun, it was not clear what was keeping it moving forward. And, in fact, of course, Galileo, in this thought experiment on the ship, was addressing that problem. And what he said was that if you have a cannonball at the top of the mast and the ship is moving forward, if you release the cannonball, there is then no force keeping it going with the ship, will it fall backwards? And Galileo, arguing in favour of what we now call Newton's first law of motion, or the law of inertia, said that no force is needed to keep a body moving in a straight line with constant speed.
Once it gets going, it will just keep going until something stops it. And if it's stopped, it won't start going unless something pushes it.
So that gradually, through the development of these ideas of mechanics, the problem of explaining planetary motion planetary orbiting around the Earth, around the Sun, was not to explain why the planet was moving forward, but to explain why it continually curved round, and to use a phrase that they used at the time, kept falling towards the Earth. As it, or in the case of the Moon, or in the case of a planet, kept falling towards the Sun.
This is Dr. Keith Runcorn with us on Conversations. Dr. Runcorn holds the Sidney Chapman Chair of Natural Sciences at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and has since 1989. He is a physicist and a geophysicist, educated at Cambridge and Manchester, his bachelor's and his master's and doctor of science all from Cambridge, his PhD from Manchester. He spent the good portion of his teaching time as professor of physics and head of the School of Physics at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne from 1963 to 1988. He joined the faculty at the University of Alaska Fairbanks in 1989. Our topic today on Conversations is Galileo, the thinking and beliefs of the time, which were a combination of religious and scientific belief, and the difference that men like Copernicus, Galileo, and much later Newton made in the way people look at the earth on which they stand. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations on KUAC. Was Galileo one of the first people to return to physical experiments? When I asked you about dropping the ball from the top of the mast, a great number of stories about Galileo center on physical experimentation.
Yes, he was a pioneer in the experimental method. Of course, some others had put forward the view, Francis Bacon in England, that the way forward was careful observation and the drawing of conclusions from observation. One experiment that Galileo did, which was very important, is he investigated the laws of accelerated motion. When we drop a stone, of course, it moves faster and faster until it hits the ground. This is what we call acceleration. But it was hard at that time to study carefully what happened, and Galileo found that it was much easier if you had an inclined plane and let an object roll down this slightly inclined plane, and then you had very much more time to observe what happened. And so experiments like this were the beginning of the understanding of mechanics.
Why did so few people in the time prior to Galileo do physical experiments? It seems like it's a natural thing for human beings to do. We're governed not just by our intellect, but also by our senses. So we touch, we fool with things, we build things.
Well, I think, of course, in ordinary life, people, human beings, have always done experiments. But we're talking now about more academic questions, such as the cosmos and the rule of thinking, which had, of course, been handed down from Aristotle, was that one should begin from general principles and argue logically. And so that procedure gave very little opportunity for experimentation. But it is rather surprising that 1,000 years was to pass before this way of drawing conclusions about the natural world should give way to what we now know as modern science.
Do you think it was the, what's the word I'm trying to think of, the catalyst of the Renaissance, that so much was changing in the thinking, especially in Italy, which was such a rich intellectual center?
Yes, and of course, through both the Renaissance and also, of course, through the Arab world, the early observations of the Greeks in astronomy and mechanics became available for people to study. Printing, of course, was another way in which knowledge was disseminated.
This is Dr. Keith Runcorn on Conversations. We're talking about Galileo. The telescope was probably Galileo's most pivotal apparatus, but there were others as well. There was something called a pulsifier or a pulse meter where he, now this again may be apocryphal, but he is said to have watched a pendulum swinging.
Yes, that was of course another contribution to the early development of mechanics to discover what we know as the isochronous movement of the pendulum. That is, that weight on the end of a rope, when it is set in motion, its period of motion does not depend on the angle through which the rope swings. And that discovery was made by Galileo, and probably through seeing a swinging lantern in the Cathedral of Pisa. He timed it by his pulse.
Mm-hmm. And then an apparatus he made became, tell me if this is true, became useful to time the pulses of ill people. A pulse could be standardized. Most of us have the same pulse. But if you are, you may have a rapid pulse or a slow pulse if you're ill. So doctors found this useful, is that right?
Yes, well, of course, once people got the idea that simple apparatus could be made to register important phenomena, the development of physical apparatus went ahead. For example, in Italy, the discovery of the barometer followed rather quickly on the experiments we're talking about. Mm-hmm. People got the idea that observations could be made of natural phenomena by very simple instruments. In 1600, in England, William Gilbert, who was physician to Queen Elizabeth, wrote the first treatise on experimental physics, and it was on the phenomena of magnetism. Well, the phenomena of magnetism had been known certainly in the West since about 1100, because the compass was used in navigation, and before that in China. But Gilbert was the first person to systematically discover the properties of magnets, that they have poles and that like poles repel and so on. Mm-hmm. And his book, De Magnete, which also shows that the Earth itself is a big magnet that has a magnetic field, depended on the measurements which were made using compass needles.
Many of Galileo's thoughts went against the grain. He taught at Pisa, and he taught for many years at Padua. He was more popular as a professor, I understand, at Padua, which was a more liberal university. But in both places, things he said were distressing to the Aristotelian professors. One of the reasons I asked the questions about the apparatus he invented was that it seemed to me in reading that the apparatus made him more welcome, whether it was a geometric and military compass or whether it was a rudimentary thermometer or the pulsifier, and that the telescope was a different kind of invention because it both helped his popularity and then later distressed it. And that's what I was wondering if you would address. Is
well, of course, the Galileo had been active. He didn't become famous until the invention of the telescope, but the telescope, of course, resulted in everyone knowing who Galileo was, and he, of course, presented telescopes to important people, and he wrote a book describing his results. He, in that book, argued, of course, in favor of the Copernican system. And in the course of doing this, he made enemies. And there is still a very great puzzle attached to why the Church of Rome was so foolish to attempt to suppress, first of all, the Copernican book, and then, of course, to bring him to trial. The result had a disastrous effect on the development of science in Italy, and, of course, it greatly damaged the Roman Catholic Church, and many books are still addressing many books have been published very recently addressing the problem of why was this heavy-handed attempt made at suppression of the Copernican system and of Galileo in particular.
It does seem that the church would have appeared far more graceful if it had slowly integrated the thinking of Copernicus, because there were theologians who were compelled to his thinking. Isn't that so?
Oh, the Jesuit College in Rome had many astronomers who made important contributions, and they verified Galileo's observations through the telescope, because, of course, at first people were skeptical that these moons of Jupiter really existed. Perhaps they were a smudge on the lens of the telescope or an atmospheric phenomena, as comets had been long supposed to be. And the Jesuit College in Rome did, in fact, give Galileo support.
This is Dr. Keith Runcorn speaking with us today on Conversations. He has most recently been a visiting scholar at the University of Sydney in Australia in 1991 and 1993. His awards are a great many. Just in the last few years, from the European Union of Geosciences, the Royal Astronomical Society, and American Geophysical Union, he's written actively in his fields for over four decades, and those fields are, a little more specifically than physics and geophysics, geomagnetism, paleomagnetism, continental drift, solid-state physics, mantle convection, planetary interiors, and evolution, and more. We're listening to Dr. Keith Runcorn today on the subject of Galileo. Why do you think the Church chose to bring Galileo before trial at the Inquisition, or trial by the Inquisition?
Well, I'm not a historian, but I can't help wondering whether the war of religion, which was going on in Germany, was an important factor. The 30 Years' War began in 1618, and for a while the Catholics were very successful. And then in 1830, the military genius, King Gustav Adolphus of Sweden, landed with his army in Pomerania to support the Protestant cause. And in just about 2 years, they destroyed the Austrian and Bavarian armies. And just about the time that Galileo was brought before the Inquisition, the whole of Germany was under the control of the Swedes and their Protestant allies. And I would have thought that it would have brought panic to Rome, the thought that an army which had been uniformly victorious was on the northern side of the Alpine passes. And governments, and we've seen it happen, of course, in this century, when they're faced with challenges of that kind, can do irrational things. And that is one suggestion, but there are many others. One very popular idea is that Pope Urban VIII had, before he was elevated to the papacy, been a friend and supporter of Galileo. Before he was the Pope, he was Cardinal Barberini, and he had stated that in 1616, when Copernicus's book was suppressed, he had argued against the suppression. When he became Pope, he had many conversations with Galileo, encouraged him to continue to discuss in print the Copernican system, but he made some suggestions about how Galileo should treat the question, and Galileo published this famous book, The Dialogue of the Two World Systems, which, as its name implies, was a mock dialogue between two supporters and an opponent of the Copernican system. And the opponent, who had the name Simplicitas, put forward, of course, among other views, which were ridiculed by the other two, an argument that the Pope had given Galileo. You know, he said, think about this argument, Galileo, which might be an argument against accepting the reality of the Copernican system. And Galileo included it, but put it in the mouth of the person who got squashed by the other proponents. And so many people think, and there is some evidence for it, that the Pope was personally affronted by Galileo.
But
I don't think we shall ever know what was in the, what went through Pope Urban's mind when he made the decision that Galileo should come before the Inquisition, and when he insisted that the case should not be dismissed, but that Galileo should receive punishment.
Mm-hmm. Urban VIII was bright, an intellectual as well as a theologian. Do you think he cannot have known what he was doing in terms of consequence when he did that?
The Pope?
Yeah.
I think another factor that one must remember is that people in that position have many problems to deal with. Mm. I, of course, explained, and it's quite clearly true that the Pope was much concerned with the 30 Years' War and the future of Catholicism was at stake. He'd quarrelled with the Spanish and the Austrians about how to deal with the situation in Germany. And I've no doubt that he hadn't a great deal of time to devote to the Galileo affair, and he almost certainly underestimated the important consequences that followed.
Mm-hmm. Among other things, Dr. Keith Runcorn serves on a papal academy which advises the Pope on matters scientific. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. Galileo, our subject today, was born in Italy in 1564. He lived until 1642, a physicist and astronomer said to have revived the art of experimentation in science and given the scientific method the encouragement it needed to live again. Tell me, though, what damage you feel the Inquisition, the Pope's decision to quash both Copernicus and Galileo did to the future of science in that time period?
Well, it certainly obviously greatly discouraged scientific endeavor in Italy, which had up to that time been very thriving, and the center of gravity of the scientific movement, of course, went north to Germany and England, Holland, and France. And when you look at the great scientists of the next century, you see the names of Newton in England, Huygens, a Dutchman, and many famous mathematicians in France. And it's hard not to suppose that the censorship imposed by the Roman Catholic Church had not a very serious effect on science in Italy.
What about the effect on the church? In some ways, isn't it just a natural growing pain of the two disciplines growing apart, theology finding a life separate from science, and science coming into its own?
Yes, well, of course, as I said, the culture was integrated before the events that I've been talking about, and afterwards, of course, culture was a shattered one, and science became an autonomous field of study, often, of course, hostile to religion. And, of course, one can see how each development in science, the beginning of geology, for example, will be celebrated in 2 years' time with the bicentenary of the publication of James Hutton's The Earth. Before then, there was really no understanding of what the rocks on the Earth's surface told us about Earth history. After that time, of course, it was recognized that the Earth has an extremely long history. And then, of course, at the middle of last century, there was Darwin's theory of evolution. And each of these developments of the experimental method, because, of course, the development of geology was the result of observation of rocks, and, of course, eventually the application of experimental physics to, for example, determine geological age. And at each time, part, not of course all, but part of the Christian Church regarded these developments as a threat to religion and opposed them, and resulted, of course, in very great damage to the Christian Church.
And when you say it resulted in damage to the Church, what do you mean? What kinds of damage?
In the Middle Ages, the Church was a central institution. In fact, it was an institution more powerful than most states. Today, the Christian Church is a minority of people. Of course, as a result of the Enlightenment in the 18th century, the divorce of church and state was written into the American Constitution and into the constitution of many European states. And undoubtedly, this process was hastened by the fact that the church came into confrontation with the important developments of science and usually turned out to be on the losing side.
I don't know whether this is a correct question for a physicist or not, but is there an enlightened perspective that you think the church should take on issues of science?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that question?
Yeah, as I say, I don't know whether this is a fair question for a physicist, but do you think that there is an enlightened state, an enlightened position for the church relative to issues pertaining to science? Is it to let science be science? And
well, of course, there are many deep-thinking Christian intellectuals and, of course, Christian leaders who have attempted to reconcile modern science with religion. But their attempts, I think, have not been successful in reaching ordinary people. For example, there's been a great deal of very important historical research done on the biblical texts, the development of archaeology in last century, and the development of a scientific procedure in historical research has thrown a tremendous new light on the documents of the Old and New Testament, but that has not got through to the general mass of either believers or non-believers.
Well, Dr. Runcorn, thank you very much for your time with us on Conversations. For people who want to learn more about Galileo, a book I found very interesting from the University of Chicago Press, 1993, is Novelties in the Heavens. Jean Dietz Moss is the author of Novelties in the Heavens, published in 93. Dr. Runcorn recommends Galileo the Heretic, published, we think, in 1989, and in 1993, Galileo the Courtier, taking different views on why Galileo came before the Inquisition and the impact of that event on his life and science. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. Thank you for joining us today. I hope you join us again next week. Thank you very much, Dr. Runcorn.